In Studio 360, we talk about people being creative and making art all the time. Today, let's turn it over to some other creatures.
We can imagine that Mozart's symphonies transformed the audience's ability to imagine what music could be. The same is true of the peacock's tail.
I'll talk with a biologist who argues that all kinds of animals make art.
Birds do it. Bees do it.
Bees are making aesthetic choices. If they weren't, all flowers would look the same. The flower is communicating to the bee, remember the nectar you had yesterday?
We'll hear about the greatest hits of humpback whales, a nature movie from a bat's point of view, and a very exclusive concert. Wolves only.
Until we teach the animals capitalism, I don't expect to be collecting any money at the door.
So do animals have culture? We'll find out today in Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. That, in case you didn't know, is a humpback whale singing. Today in Studio 360, we're going to hear about whales singing, birds dancing, animals making what seems an awful lot like art. We've known for a long time that some animals apparently do things for purely aesthetic reasons. Bower birds decorate their nests with colorful bits of string and foil. Octopuses are known to carefully arrange interesting shiny objects outside their dens. No, as far as we know, octopuses do not make gardens. Scientists are looking at all these behaviors to ask seriously whether animals make aesthetic judgments. What shapes their preferences and how? Whether animals have what we could call culture. We've certainly been forcing our tastes on them for a long time. There is a whole music industry catering to pet owners. If you've got one of those dogs that cries when you leave for work, there are CDs to calm them down, usually classical music. But did Rusty tell you he liked Chopin?
Certainly classical music isn't calming for all people. The species you are determines what's audible to you. But beyond that, we really all have different tastes and preferences. And I think other animals really have more diverse tastes and preferences than we normally give them credit for.
That's Laurel Brightman. She's been putting on concerts for animals. No humans allowed. Britt Ray has her story.
Laurel Brightman got interested in what music animals like because she was writing about how animals go mad. She researches their depressions and anxieties and says that captive animals generally suffer the most.
And it's because captive animals have so much time on their hands. And if their minds aren't stimulated and challenged, they can end up with all kinds of disturbing behaviors. And, you know, boredom is a pretty extreme stressor.
Laurel is a historian of science, but she's not just a researcher. She wants to enrich captive animals' lives by giving them something to do to occupy their time. About 4 years ago, she got an idea.
I read an article that was published in the late 19th century called Music for Animals, and it was an article about all of the Victorian music concerts that had been performed for other animals, things like concerts for elephants in Paris or milkmaids singing to the cows while they were milking them. And I got interested in the idea of what would happen if I decided to do this now.
And now, over 100 years later, Laurel throws concerts for all kinds of animals. For example,
I had the band Grass Widow come to Boston and play for the gorillas at Franklin Park Zoo. Jason Holt of the UK band Spectrum came and droned for sea lions on the California coast. Goodshield Aguilar is a native musician, played for the buffalo in Golden Gate Park. I don't ever open these up to human audiences. The whole point is that it's a concert for other creatures.
And it's on her own dime. There's no research funding.
Until we teach the animals capitalism, I don't expect to be collecting any money at the door. So I can't pay anyone. I haven't been paid. And everyone who's helped me with these has donated their time.
Do you wish you were
The most recent concert was by Black Prairie, a bluegrass-inspired group from Portland, Oregon. They played for 52 wolves at a sanctuary called Wolf Haven in Washington State.
Wolves arrive at Wolf Haven for all kinds of reasons. Many were rescued from a roadside wolf attraction in Alaska. They were never let off the chain. So until they finally shut down this place, many of these wolves, they'd never run. They'd never touched noses with another canid. Really, they just had the worst kind of life.
On the day of the wolf concert, the band started playing after the heat of the day had passed. The wolves were just waking up after napping in the sun.
The Mexican wolves are standing at the very edge of their enclosure at the spot that's closest to us, making unbroken eye contact. And the wolves, they're just clearly, clearly interested. They have a huge enclosure, and they could be anywhere. And they're right at the closest place to the band.
Laurel's concert is not exactly a scientific study, but other scientists are interested in the questions it raises, like Mark Beckoff, professor emeritus from the University of Colorado at Boulder. He spent his career looking at wolf, coyote, and dog behavior.
What's so mysterious and so intriguing when you consider the question of music is they're no doubt hearing overtones and sounds that we do not hear, and we can't even begin to appreciate, you know, perhaps the complexity of what they hear in the sounds produced by musical instruments.
One in particular is maybe 3 inches away from the fence, ears pricked, almost like a dog smile.
How can we interpret an animal's psychological state with science?
Well, the use of MRIs on dogs is becoming a very, very good technique. But, you know, just purely observational. Are they nervous? Are they scratching themselves? Are they, you know, sort of looking around as if they're really wary of what's happening?
I don't know. They sort of remind me of people at an outdoor summer concert. They're kind of like paws crossed next to each other and ears pricked and paying attention, but relaxed.
Versus they kind of cock their head from side to side. They look really uncertain. They approach, they withdraw, they approach, they withdraw. Their gait may be really choppy.
There's no control on this experiment, but biologists have looked at animal appreciation of music in more controlled conditions. Charles Snowden of the University of Wisconsin-Madison works with a composer named David Tai. They've designed species-specific music that includes the sonic frequencies that the animals communicate with in nature. They've done it with house cats and these little monkeys called cotton-top tamarins.
I think the music that we prefer is not necessarily the music that our pets prefer, and we ought to be really thoughtful and careful about that. In fact, if you listen to the tamarin music, it's pretty god-awful to my listening. It sounds like a lot of scratches on a blackboard somewhere.
But they've seen that it effectively relaxes the tamarins.
For cats, we used music that has a tempo of purring or a tempo of an infant suckling on its mother.
And they say that the cats prefer their kitty music to regular human music.
We could show that the animals preferred to go to the speakers with cat music than preferred to go to the speakers with human music.
Is noticing a difference in behavior enough to say whether or not there is preference? Because preference seems to indicate some sort of likability.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because animals could just not like music at all. And there's a study that was done at Harvard University several years ago where they took the same monkeys that we studied and gave them a choice between Mozart and heavy metal. And they found that when given the choice between Mozart and heavy metal, the monkeys preferred Mozart. But then they decided to do a further test, and they presented Mozart versus silence and found that the monkeys preferred silence instead. So we have to give them a choice of that sort.
Although Laurel didn't give the wolves that choice, the person who knows them best thinks that they were definitely into it. Diane Gallegos is the director of Wolf Haven.
I was very surprised. I actually thought that once you came in with the instruments that we were going to have to ask you to leave, because I figured that they would be nervous and they'd run to the back. And instead, with the music, we saw the first group come up to the fence and listen, and then we saw the others in the other enclosures coming up to listen.
Really, the only indicator that I have is that they didn't leave, and that's really powerful. And actually, that's really how a lot of musicians judge the success of their show. Did people not leave? Did they not talk? Did they stay and seem to enjoy themselves?
At the end of the show, the band wanted to banter with the audience a little.
The staff of Wolfhaven tried to teach us how to, they call it, initiate a howl. And they said, you lean your head back and you open your mouth and then you howl. And they said they had no idea if the wolves would howl back, but we should try it.
It sounds kind of silly. But then listen to what happened.
And now all the wolves are howling in response.
Who knows what those howls meant? But it's tempting to think it's the wolves' way of calling for an encore. Because it's not like they have lighters to hold up.
Oh my God.
For Studio 360, I'm Britt Ray.
Is that okay?
Our story was supported by the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Mama, there's wolves in the house.
This is Studio 360, and in today's special episode of our Science and Creativity series, we are asking whether animals have culture. And for some insight on that question, I wanted to talk to Richard Prum. If there's such a thing as a celebrity ornithologist, he's it. You know that newish theory that birds descended from dinosaurs? Prum supplied the key piece of evidence. His interest in feathers then led him to study the physics of color, research that is now being applied to develop a new kind of paint. And Prum's study of birds has extended his area of interest into aesthetics. He's reignited a debate that has been simmering since Darwin's day. Rick Prum, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So you started thinking about aesthetics when you were studying birds called manakins in South America. What is special about manakins?
Well, manakins are tiny little chickadee-sized birds that live in South America. Unlike a lot of birds, unlike most birds, manakins are raised only by their mothers. So the female builds the nest and raises the young. All by herself. And as a result, she can choose any male she likes to mate with. And that gives rise to what we call sexual selection, mate choice. And she ends up evolving to prefer males that do elaborate dances.
And this is like an extreme version of what a lot of animals do. There's a lot of mating display and ritual, and other birds sing to get their mates. This is extreme because they don't have anything to do but pick a mate.
Right. And what makes it also extreme is that the females tend to agree on who they prefer. So the vast majority of the offspring are sired by just a few males.
Really? And so what is the dance that these males, most of whom won't get picked, do is what, more or less?
Well, each species has evolved a complex repertoire of vocal songs, wing songs or mechanical songs, and movements.
So it's a whole vaudeville act. Really.
It's opera. It's got a lot of different elements.
And what would my Biology 101 professor have said was the purpose of that manakin mating ritual?
Well, the vast majority of evolutionary biologists believe that females prefer the dances they do because those dances indicate the quality of the male. That is, that he's got good genes or that he's a good dad.
And you're saying that isn't it.
My hypothesis is that for the most part, ornament in manakins and in nature evolves merely because it's popular or merely beautiful.
Really? So for birds and obviously other kinds of animals and species, it is just art for art's sake. It's, oh, that's cool. Yeah, let's sleep together.
It's a lot like high fashion. I think that although it's genetic and doesn't quite move with the seasons, if the skirt is above the knee or below the knee, or has shoulder, or the jacket has shoulder pads or not, doesn't really matter. It doesn't even have implications for the actual function of the clothing.
Right.
What matters is that it's hot. And genetically speaking, similar kind of processes could be very common in nature.
So, I mean, not to anthropomorphize birds too much, but is it not unlike dancing we do when a girl sees a guy dancing well at a prom and thinks, yeah, I'll go out with him?
I think that we, for the most part, don't anthropomorphize birds enough. That is, we're afraid of talking about their subjective experiences, what's going on inside their heads, because we can't measure it. But in fact, what they experience is desire. What they experience is the subjective experience of beauty, of being attracted to something. And actually, that was Darwin's original idea in proposing the theory of mate choice, is that it's about the aesthetic faculty, the ability of individuals to actually observe and have opinions about the beauty of other individuals.
And it's beyond that. We talked mostly about this dance that mannequins do, but in other species, it's about color, it's about song, it's about all these aesthetic expressions.
True, from whale song to the beauty of bird plumages. All these are examples of ornament, and I believe we should really look at as a result of an aesthetic evolutionary process.
Now, as I said in the introduction, you have gone a step beyond some of your peers, I'm sure, would say a bridge too far. You're suggesting that animal aesthetic preferences amount to art in the same way that the art that we create, or the advertising that we create, or the entertainment that we create, is an aesthetic show.
That all started when I started looking at the aesthetic and aesthetic concepts in biology. And once I started to embrace them, I thought, hey, I ought to go to the rest of humanities. They have thousands of years of literature talking about what beauty is and how it changes.
And we're animals.
Right. So I then started reading in aesthetic philosophy, and I found that, at least contemporarily, it's in pretty sorry state. There isn't a lot of things people agree on. So more recently, I've been starting to do work in aesthetic philosophy, and the goal is to create intellectual tools or frameworks that allow us to understand aesthetic evolution in animals in ways that are common with the way aesthetic change occurs in communities of artists and cultures of humans.
You're not saying that there can't be distinctions made, and we may prefer and be excited by human art in a way that we aren't by mannequin dances.
Right. Well, I think that what is important is that every single kind of art evolves or exists within a community of producers and consumers or evaluators.
Right.
And the normative judgments in that art world, if you will, that population, arise as a result of the dynamics of that group. So whether it's rose-breasted grosbeak or abstract expressionism, these are communities of individuals that have interactions, aesthetic interactions.
And you're saying that that isn't an analogy, but it's the same thing, that the grosbeak's success or failure with a given song or whatever, and then they change and get one that works better, is the same thing that artists do when they respond to what critics and gallery goers are buying or reviewing well.
I wouldn't want to equate them precisely, except to say that what makes them beautiful or what makes them aesthetic is the same thing. That is, what we have is a process of coevolution. To my way of looking at it, the expression, the form of expression and the form of evaluation, the art form and the opinions of it coevolve with one another. They influence one another over time. So we can imagine that Mozart's symphonies transform the audience's ability to imagine what music could be, and that those new evaluative opinions fed back upon music, influencing greatly the history of Western music. The same is true of the peacock's tail. The peacock's tail is a consequence of a collaborative coevolution between the tail and female evaluations of those tails, and they transform one another over time. So it's that coevolutionary process which is in common, whether it's dominated by genetics or dominated by cultural interactions. And that actually by entertaining other kinds of art that isn't human art, we actually enhance the richness of our understanding of what human art is.
And you do an interesting thing in the paper I read, which is go through the objections. Well, art has intention. And then you say,
Well, you know, it's just because we can't talk to birds doesn't mean that they don't have intention or evidence of intention. In fact, there's some interesting neurobiological evidence showing that the brain state of a bird who's singing to himself, a male bird singing to himself, or singing in the presence of another male, indicates that he is monitoring and listening to his own song. But when he sings to a female who is a potential mate, those self-monitoring parts of the brain are not active, only the production. So birds have a brain state difference between practice and performance, right? And so that indicates that at least they are not a music box being wound up and playing.
Right.
They know what's going when they're on stage.
Yeah.
And that's correlated with intention. If we had that evidence for a person that we couldn't otherwise communicate with, we would say, this person has the intention. They know the difference between this context and that. Aesthetic philosophers and philosophers in general, I don't think have really entertained the full richness of biology before and realized that their definitions or accounts of what art is fail to eliminate biological phenomena. And so, therefore, they've got to decide, are we going to be a human-defined discipline or are we going to be something broader?
So your definition of art includes things like flowers and bees, but you don't really mean they're consciously making art, do you?
Yeah, they don't have to be conscious in order to be art. And I think flowers and bees are a great example. Bees are making aesthetic choices. If they weren't, all flowers would look the same. But the flower is communicating to the bee and saying, remember the nectar you had yesterday? They want to be memorably rewarding, right?
Yeah.
So flowers are diverse. And that's because bees are making choices. Are bees conscious of that?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But they don't have to be. They don't have to know about art in order to make art or be participating in art. All they have to do is be making evaluations and choices.
Right.
Aesthetics is a consequence of the opportunity for sensory perception, some kind of cognitive evaluation, and choice. And when you have those three things occurring, you have the opportunity for aesthetic evolution. And that gives rise to whole new dynamics that didn't occur when those three things are absent.
Rick Prum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Prum directs Yale University's Frank Program in Science and the Humanities. He's a professor of ornithology and a curator at Yale's Peabody Museum of Natural History. And if you want to see some of those red-capped mannequins that Richard Prum studies doing their insane dance moves, we've got a video posted at studio360.org.
Rise up this morning, smile with the rising sun.
Still ahead this hour, whales sing for their lives.
Do you make cat food out of composer poets? I think that's a crime.
Save the Whale Song. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Sotheby's Institute of Art, the graduate school of art and its markets, offering master's degrees and public programs for aspiring art world professionals at their campuses in New York, Los Angeles, London, and online. Sotheby'sInstitute.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. And today's show is all about animals being creative. Only one species other than humans has ever had a hit record. Not a bird. I love birdsong, and we all tend to take them for granted. But when whales were first recorded, they broke really big. I can remember so well as a kid putting that first record of whale songs on the turntable. Typical playlist, Rolling Stones, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Humpback Whales. Those late 60s humpback whale recordings revolutionized how we thought about these animals and how we think about other species in general. Michael May has our story.
This I've always thought was the best recorded song.
That's biologist Roger Payne. He's at home in landlocked Vermont, listening to the songs of his beloved humpback whales in a wood-paneled living room.
And that sort of theme evolves as the whale sings it. These sounds are, with no exception that I can think of, the most evocative, most beautiful sounds made by any animal on Earth.
Payne began his career studying the sounds made by bats and moths. Then in 1966, he turned his attention to whales. At that point, there was very little known about the sounds whales made, or why they made them. He went to Bermuda, where whales passed on their migratory routes. And there he met sound engineer and military researcher Frank Watlington. And it was Watlington who gave Payne this recording. He wasn't even sure what it was.
You're going to hear explosions of dynamite. That's what Frank was listening for, was those sounds. And the whale was just getting in his way. But it's more than that. Frank was the one who had the presence of mind to record this and hang on to it.
Payne brought the recordings back to his office in New York, and he listened deeply.
And I would just leave it on, just going again and again and again. And when you do that to something, you can't help but memorize it. I mean, of course you hear, you don't even have to think about it. You just eventually, you know what it does. And after a long while of listening to this, I suddenly realized, my God, this thing is repeating itself.
This was a startling discovery. If an animal repeats a sound, like a bird or a cricket, well, then it's technically a song. These, however, were arguably the most complex songs of any animal. They were 10 minutes long or more, and there was no break before they repeated. Payne and a colleague used a spectrograph to turn the songs into visual patterns. Their work was published in the journal Science. At the time, whales were being hunted to extinction. Roger Payne saw the songs as a call to arms.
Do you make cat food out of composer poets? I think that's a crime.
For the next 2 years, Roger Payne spent as much time distributing these recordings as studying them. He gave them to musicians, composers, singers.
What I wanted to do was try to build them into human culture. Anything, any damn thing that anybody wanted to try, hey, that seemed fine to me.
It was 1969 in the summer, and I was playing the long-suffering Solveig in Peer Gynt.
That singer, Judy Collins.
And this tall man came backstage, and I didn't know him. He said, I'm Roger Payne. I study whales. I'm a cetologist. And he handed me this little package.
Inside was a reel-to-reel tape. She took it home and put it on.
I was very emotional. Angst for being a human being on a planet where they also live. guilt for doing what we do to them. And that they're so smart and they've been here so long. And they certainly might have some insights about what we could do to live a better way.
Farewell to Tarwati. Adieu, Mormonti.
This is Farewell to Tarwati from Collins' 1970 record Whales and Nightingales. It's a traditional whaling song. The record went gold, and it introduced millions to the songs of the humpback whales. Collins says the whales sing in their own scale, and she intuitively matches it.
In hunting the whale.
Then you hear the whales come in, and then I join them, and it is like a call and response in a way, because I am having a dialogue with them, and vice versa, because they're answering me as well. And in a sense, reaching out into the human species, trying to give us some inkling of what is going on in the real world.
Judy Collins devoted the royalties of that song to Payne's conservation work. Soon after, Capitol Records released Payne's recordings of humpback whale songs. It's still the best-selling natural sounds album of all time. And just as Payne had hoped, these strange, mournful sounds inspired a movement. Save the whales. By 1972, the United States had banned whaling and whale products.
This was part of a moment.
George Lipsitz is an American studies professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He used to hear the whales on a community radio station in St. Louis.
The whale sounds and the ocean sounds were number one on their playlist.
At that time, there was a fight over that particular radio station. Lipsitz was in a camp that wanted more airtime for political discussions. but one of the station's managers thought the humpback whales were more radical.
It's almost like we're each hoping for a kind of magic to conjure a new world into being.
America had just experienced the Kent State shootings. The Vietnam War seemed like it would never end. There was the death of Martin Luther King. Lipset says people were questioning the very notions of progress and civilization.
And a suspicion that maybe we learn that meanness and that cruelty by establishing these rigid boundaries between the human and the animal and between culture and nature. And so there became a sense of, what if we're not alone? What if there's more to learn? What if human guile cuts us off from essential relations to other species?
But Lipset says artists were drawn to the whale songs for another reason.
There was a great effort to explore the aleatory, accidental sounds that could be made in studios and in nature. These seem like total opposites, but what they're attempting to do is to go beyond the simple chords and harmonies of pop music.
He sees the whale songs, the free jazz movement, and Jimi Hendrix's use of feedback all as part of the same artistic revolution.
Music and the thinking around it have become so conventional. If you disrupt that convention, all things become possible.
All things become possible. We don't really think that way anymore. And humpback whales no longer sell the number of records they did back in the 1970s. Of course, nobody does. These days, environmental recordings are mostly there for relaxation, like at spas. But these haunting calls continue to intrigue scientists and musicians alike. On this record from 2001, whale researcher and musician Lisa Walker went to humpback whale feeding grounds in Alaska. Using an underwater speaker and a microphone, she piped her violin down among the singing whales, captured the results, and then arranged a string concerto in the key of whale. Scientists remain mystified by the whales' complex songs, what information they convey, why they evolve. Musicians, on the other hand, continue to find their own way of going deep below the surface. For Studio 360, I'm Michael May.
And I am Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. So whales have had crossover hits in the human population, but now it turns out that some of their songs are particular hits among the whales themselves. You might imagine that whale songs were programmed genetically, that each species has its tune and that's that. But no, not at all. Humpback whales in particular change their tunes frequently. Ellen Garland is a researcher who studies how whales adopt new songs. She works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Seattle. I asked Garland how we even know they're singing and not just talking.
Well, for the humpback whales that I work with, the song is produced by the male, and it's a sexual display. So it really is a song. So we don't know whether he's singing to attract ladies or whether it's in something to do with male-male competition, but it's something to do part of the mating display. Now, the other sounds that they make are called social sounds, and those are perhaps a little bit more communicative.
Uh-huh.
Males, females, calves, juveniles can all make those social sounds.
And so talk about what you found when you looked at how the whale song does change over time.
So what I found was song types originate in the East Australian population and then were passed sequentially from one population to the next across the South Pacific. And this took approximately 2 years. In each population in each year, all males will sing the same song type, so they're matching. And then the song will change in a small progressive way through time. But we also found that these brand new song types would appear in the population and then revolutionize the song in that population. And this happened really rapidly, say within a season, which is 2 to 3 months. So they're learning this brand new display, throwing the old one straight out the window and incorporating it all in. So it's a very rapid time.
It's just, I love this fact. I thank you for discovering it. And so when you say that they this radically new song, how different? Could I hear the difference?
I think you could. So humpback song is composed of multiple different sounds, but it's how they arrange them each year that changes.
I want to play a clip of one of the songs here. Now, if you can tell me what's going on in this recording, what do you hear that I don't hear?
I hear a number of sounds being repeated, and that makes up a phrase there. And you can hear suddenly we've gone into a different type of sounds here. And this is a new phrase. This is a new theme. So what you've got is just one phrase from each theme of this particular song type.
And then I want to play the song that, I guess, replaced that one in the following season.
Yes. So you can see how the sound's different.
Definitely.
And it appears that they seem to like novelty in their songs. So when small changes come into the population or a completely new song type comes in, they seem to grab onto this novel song, and all the males in the population will change to this new song type. And we think this is linked in, of course, with sexual selection and the males wanting to be that little bit different to the male next to them, to possibly be a little bit more attractive to that female.
Uh-huh. And it does it quickly. It is really impossible to resist saying, well, this is just like pop music in the human world.
Yeah, the music industry, or sometimes fashion. And, you know, if someone's wearing a new fashion, everyone suddenly wants to wear that new piece of clothing.
So you call these cultural transformations. What in your scientific world what is cultural about them?
Well, culture is basically learning. They have to learn them from other whales around them, and then they're copying them. So it's not genetically based.
Uh-huh.
They're learning them from other animals, so it's a cultural aspect.
Yeah. It seems to me this passing of more novel artifacts from population to population, it sounds awful lot like art or entertainment to me.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very interesting cultural transmission, so it really is a cultural trait.
Yeah.
And the more research that everyone is doing, the more they're finding that different animals seem to have at least one, if not a suite, of cultural traits, which is really interesting.
I could talk to you all day about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Garland is a biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And you can hear some of her recordings of whale songs going in and out of style at studio360.org.
Word, because I've heard that song before. The lyrics said forevermore, forevermore's a memory. Please have them play it again, and I'll remember just when I heard that lovely song.
You're listening to Studio 360. We've been talking about how birds and wolves and whales express and teach their preferences culturally. And if animals could make their own wildlife movies, what would those sound like? Happy Feet 3? Not exactly.
I was 3 wet seasons old when I first detected the wonderful odor. It was coming from her sexual opening.
A new breed of animal cartoons. That's just ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
The fish wade through black jade. Of the crow blue mussel shells, one keeps adjusting the ash heaps.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. And that is Marianne Moore.
The barnacles which encrust the side of the wave cannot hide there, for the submerged shafts of the sun split like spun glass.
She was a giant in American poetry in the last century. Despite writing notoriously difficult poems, Moore became famous, enough to throw the first pitch at a Yankees game at age 80 in 1968. Along with baseball, Moore was also a big nature buff. She read natural history, went to biology lectures, and she especially loved the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where she would study the dioramas of habitats. She liked to talk to animal experts and to kids visiting the museum. In a series of poems from the 1930s, she wrote about some of the exotic animals she found there: the Arctic ox, the pangolin, which resembles an armadillo, and the jerboa, a giant-eared rodent that looks like a cartoon character. Here's Moore reading her poem, Rigorists, about reindeer.
We saw reindeer browsing, a friend who'd been in Lapland said, finding their own food. They are adapted to scant rhino or pasture, yet they can run 11 miles in 50 minutes. The feet spread when the snow is soft and act as snowshoes. They are rigorists. However handsome...
With all the details she packs in there, it sounds almost like a Wikipedia page in verse. And that's partly the point. Since Aesop's fables, people have projected human characteristics onto animals. The brave lion, the cunning fox, the wise owl. Marianne Moore was interested in what animals are actually like. She thought science could be the stuff of poetry as well, and if there was a moral to the particular story, she let it come out of the animal's actual behavior. Here she is reading from her poem, The Wood Weasel, which is not actually an animal. It's her personal rebranding of the skunk.
The wood weasel emerges daintily, the skunk, don't laugh, in sylvan black and white chipmunk regalia. The inky thing, adaptively whited with glistening goat fur, is Woodwarden. In his ermined, well, cuttlefish-inked wool, he is determination's totem. Outlawed, his sweet face and powerful feet go about in chieftain's coat of Chilcat cloth. He is his own protection from the moth, noble little warrior. That otter skin on it, the living polecat, smothers anything that stings. Well, this same weasel's playful, and his weasel associates are too. Only wood weasels shall associate with me.
Artists depicting animals in scientifically accurate ways is still kind of an avant-garde move, just as it was in Marianne Moore's time. From Aesop to Brer Rabbit to Disney, we like animals to talk like us, think like us, and...
repeat after me.
Give us easy life lessons.
Hakuna Matata.
What?
It means no worries.
Studio 360's Sarah Lilly spoke with two artists who are trying to buck the anthropomorphic conventions, imagining animals' lives as the animals might see them.
If you grew up loving Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, or even Charlotte's Web, the new novel called The Bees is a different animal entirely. Some reviewers have dubbed it the watership down for the Hunger Games generation. I asked author Lillian Paul to read a little excerpt.
With a hard, erratic pulse in the ground, a young female came running down the corridor between the cells, her face frantic. Halt! Harsh voices reverberated from both ends of the corridor, and a strong, astringent scent rose into the air. Every bee stopped moving, but the young bee stumbled and fell across Flora's pile of debris. Then she clawed her way into the remains of the broken cell and huddled in the corner, her little hands up. Cloaked in a bitter scent which hid their faces and made them identical, the dark figures strode down the corridor towards Flora. Pushing her aside, they dragged out the weeping young bee. At the sight of their spiked gauntlets, a spasm of fear in Flora's brain released more knowledge. They were police.
"You fled inspection."
One of them pulled at the girl's wings while another examined the four still wet membranes. The edge of one was shriveled.
"Spare me," she cried. "I will not fly. I will serve in any other way. Deformity is evil. Deformity is not permitted." Before the bee could speak, the two officers pressed her head down until there was a sharp crack. She hung limp between them and they dropped her body in the corridor.
"You." A peculiar rasping voice addressed Flora, and she did not know which one spoke, but stared at the black hooks on the back of their legs.
"Hold still." Long black calipers slid from their gauntlets and they measured her height. Excessive variation. Abnormal.
Flora turns out to be a laying worker bee. That's a term for the rare worker who can lay eggs. Now, only the queen is really authorized to spawn, and the beehive is pretty totalitarian in its vibe.
The fertility police do band together in small groups and go hunting down the laying worker, and they do kill her and eat the eggs. I stuck as far as I could to the truth of the biology of the organism because that really is wilder than anything you could make up.
Lillene Paul takes these biological facts but creates this emotional, action-packed drama. On the other hand, we have Jim Traynor. Jim's a Chicago filmmaker who's mainly known for these fantastic hand-drawn cartoons of animals. They're on 16mm film, all black and white with this flickery, old-timey feel. Really, they're pretty cute. But the animals aren't wearing clothes or going to jobs or holding hands. No soap operas here. Just factual events delivered as deadpan as possible.
The film that I started doing this animal theme is called The Bats. The bat in my movie is just kind of describing all the things in his life. He likes to eat earthworms, and he likes to fly around at night. He has all these carnal pleasures that he's sort of describing sort of dryly.
I was 3 wet seasons old when I first detected the wonderful odor. What was it? Like sweat and moonlight and mashed up moths. It was coming from her sexual opening. That spring, I had sexual intercourse with 42 different girls.
Yeah, the narration is the only thing that sort of anthropomorphizes them. I mean, their behavior as enacted on screen is basically naturalistic. I take a kind of a Darwinian worldview, and nature to me seems quite ugly. So I like to sort of emphasize that aspect of it. For instance, there's a phenomenon among lions that when a lion takes over a pride, he goes around and he kills all the lion cubs, and then he mates with all the lionesses.
I killed my girlfriend's children, which is to say, I killed all the children of all of my girlfriends.
It's sort of like, yeah, if you just put the mouth on them, then all of this would come out just the way it comes out of a human. And I feel like that's not true. Not true.
Alexandra Horowitz is awesome, and she's got a great sense of humor, but she's also totally bumming my cartoon high. She's a cognitive scientist who studies animal behavior at Barnard. She's also written about the behavior of people studying animal behavior. To quote, in studies of animal behavior, there is near official consensus about anthropomorphizing. It is to be avoided. Now, I'm a crazy dog person, so I actually laughed.
It's great that you thought that was a funny paper, because I doubt that it's ever been read as a paper of humor. I mean, where we take it as a sort of serious matter to be wrangled with and pinned down under our feet, and artists, you know, anthropomorphize with impunity.
So Lillene Paul's book, The Bees.
She does seem to superimpose, you know, some human drama on it. On the other hand, there's a lot of conveyance of, you know, facts about bees, which is kind of fantastic to get people into the hive, as it were, and sort of get them interested in that.
Is it the kind of book you would ever read?
Probably not, no. I mean, I do know I am fascinated by bees, but I tend to read, like, scientific works on bees.
the bee manual.
Yeah. But what's okay? Some things are more difficult. And I don't have any fantasy that just by observing or really having an understanding of the biological reality of a species' life, that then you know what it's like to be that species. But there is some grace in dropping the thing that we carry around with us all the time, our humanness, and just trying to observe.
But come on, drop our humanness? Who can do that? I mean, Lillene Paul and Jim Traynor are trying to present animals accurately. But imagining how others feel, other people, other creatures? That's being human at its best, right?
I can't help but think of Lillian Paul out in her garden with her magnifying glass.
It's awesome, truly. There are miracles and works of art all around us, and I think writing The Bees gave me a reason to stop and lie on the ground and just stare at what was happening right in front of me and see it for the first time again.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
You can see one of Jim Trainor's movies at studio360.org. And that is it for today's program. Thank you very much for listening. You can find all of our many dozens of stories about science and creativity at studio360.org. And while you're at the site, tell us about your creative New Year's resolutions. Is there some artistic project you've been meaning to bite off and could use a little encouragement and discipline? In the past, we've heard from a graphic novelist working on a book, a guitarist who was forming a new band. Maybe this coming year is your year. Tell us what you want to do in a comment at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azoulay,
Scott Ross.
Very special thanks to Sophia Wynn for her research on this week's show. And regular, but still heartfelt thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Are you all right?
Am I?
Are you?
There's never been a film adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's brilliantly freaked out novels. Until now.
He's technically Jewish, but wants to be a Nazi.
I'll talk with Paul Thomas Anderson, the director of Inherent Vice, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.